The American Civil Liberties Union published an open letter to Trump in the New York Times saying they would be, quote, vigilant every day of his presidency. One of their stated concerns, a potential ban on Muslims entering the country, as well as targeted surveillance of Muslim Americans. Civil rights advocates draw cautionary parallels from this moment in history to the 1940s, when the U.S. government forcibly incarcerated more than 100,000 Japanese Americans. One Oakland man, Fred Korematsu, defied the government order and, with the help of the Northern California ACLU, mounted a legal challenge to his forced relocation. Korematsu's case was unsuccessful. He and his family were ultimately relocated to Utah. He was convicted of disloyalty and lived with that ruling for 40 years until April 1984, when a federal court granted his petition for a writ of quorum nobis, or a notice of error, and vacated his conviction. Back in 2009, the Asian Law Caucus launched the Fred T. Korematsu Institute for Civil Rights and Education in San Francisco. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down with T.T. Liu, who at the time was Asian Law Caucus Executive Director, and Don Tamaki, who served as a member of the pro bono legal team that helped overturn Korematsu's conviction. Ben asked Tamaki to bring us back to the Bay Area in the early 40s.
December 7, 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Within a day or two, the Secret Service swept through Japanese-American communities all along the West Coast, here in San Francisco and Oakland, San Jose, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, all the way down to Arizona. And arrested, when they did sweep through the communities, they arrested community leaders. These were teachers, civic leaders, organizational heads, and so on. Within weeks after that, there were orders to report to assembly centers. So throughout the West, in this area, Tanforan, which is now a shopping center, was a racetrack. And they surrounded it with barbed wire and machine gun towers. And the local Japanese-American community was herded into those locations to be housed in horse stalls, essentially, without heat, hot water, you know, the basics. And this was men, women, young and old, babies, sick, it didn't matter. They got swept into this. There was a clamor to round up Japanese Americans and put them away. People saw it as their patriotic duty. So this came to America wrapped in a flag. And ultimately, by the end of 1942, almost 120,000 men, women, and children who were Americans had lost their freedom, they'd lost their property. Some even died in those camps, so they lost their lives. All of this was done without trial, without evidence. No one was ever charged with espionage or sabotage. It was done on the naked accusation of the army alone that this was a dangerous population.
So Fred Korematsu was 22 years old, as I understand. He was a welder in Oakland.
He was.
When he was gathered and sent to Tanforan and eventually to Utah. He was a pretty young man.
He was. Unlike the rest of the Japanese Americans and his family, he ignored the orders to report to the assembly center. And he parted ways with his family, who urged him to go with them, and he did not. He was in love at the time with an Italian-American girl, so he had strong reasons to stay. And just like Rosa Parks, who just wanted to have her seat on the bus, Fred just wanted to live life normally as an American citizen. He changed his name. All Japanese-American were issued cards that said enemy alien classification. And can you imagine if you're an American citizen born and raised in this country and you're getting a card saying that you're an enemy alien?
This is essentially like a driver's license or an ID card?
It was a registration card, and Fred discarded that, adopted the name of Clyde Serra, and went about his business and got a job as a welder. But ultimately, he was spotted by someone who knew him in San Leandro, and he was arrested, taken to the Presidio, and charged with being in an excluded zone in defiance of the military orders. You know, the court was only interested in two things. Are you Japanese American? And were you in the Bay Area, which was an excluded zone against military orders? He was convicted of a crime. He appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court. Fred thought he would get justice because he deeply believed in this country. And he couldn't believe that this could happen to him. And to his surprise, he lost. The conviction was upheld. And so for the next 40 years, it ate at him. And Fred didn't even tell his own daughter. You know, I mean, his own kids found out in a civics class that he was Fred Korematsu of the Korematsu versus the United States, a case that most scholars had roundly criticized as a civil liberties disaster.
In 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Presidential Medal of Freedom, saying his name should stand with those of others who fought for justice, like Homer Plessy or Oliver Brown and his daughter Linda. They were all part of well-known racial segregation cases like Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus the Board of Education. Clinton also mentioned Rosa Parks. And they're all iconic figures. But I have to admit, I didn't grow up in the Bay Area, and in my public school education, I didn't really learn about the Korematsu case. And I'm wondering, T.D. Liu, why do you think his case isn't as well known as some of these others across the country?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think part of it has to do with the work that's yet to be done in terms of community education. The Coram Nobis decision in 1984 really vindicated Fred Korematsu. It vacated his original conviction, and it allowed him to really unleash his potential as a civil rights leader. After that, he crisscrossed the country talking about what had happened to him, what had happened to Japanese Americans, but more importantly, how those issues and those constitutional principles were still very relevant today. In particular, after 9/11, he stood in strong solidarity with Arab Americans, with people of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent who were being targeted and stigmatized and discriminated against, again, using the national security justification.
After 9/11, when huge ethnic groups were completely blanketed as being targets of discrimination, of being the enemy. Mm-hmm. When we had a president who was targeting entire nations as being part of an axis of evil, why aren't these lessons learned?
I think what happened after 9/11 is exactly the dynamic that Don just described, which is that the groups that are targeted for discrimination are the very groups that feel like they have to prove their loyalty. They have to prove their patriotism. It shouldn't be that way, but that's the frame that people are put into.